The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, the entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts today, Jonathan Larson, of the University of Nebraska.
And I am your other host, Jody Green, also from the University of Nebraska.
And over here, tickling the harmonica, is our guest. If you would like to introduce yourself.
Hey, Jim Kalish here, diagnostician for the Department of Entomology for 33 years in extension.
Yeah.
33 años, sí.
We are very excited to have you on the show, Jim. You are one of our mentors. We love working with you. We love hearing your stories, and we love learning from you. And I think that our listeners will as well.
Mm-hmm. And I love you guys' energy. You guys got such energy, and you got so much potential here to absorb so much over the years in your experience. So that's what happened to me. So.
And because you can't see him, he's giving us this funny smile and these eyebrows.
Can you do the eyebrow wiggle? Mm-hmm.
No, I can't. I can't do that. No. No. Yeah.
But Jim is the diagnostician for the Department of Entomology here at the University of Nebraska. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that means, what your role is, what do you do?
Well, it is a full-time extension position, and it has equivalents in other departments originally, like in weed science and in plant pathology, even in horticulture, and then, of course, in entomology. And so, essentially, all these areas need the residents of Nebraska need to have someone to turn to for accurate identification information about some kind of a pest that they would have. And so whether it be a plant or just a plant identification or some kind of a insect or arthropod pest, what is it? And the most frequent question I get, and since it's my last year, I can harp a little bit, but I detest this question because I've heard it so many times. What is it? And how do I get rid of it?
Those are the two.
Yeah. But, you know, we have to understand that the general public, at best, have had some biology in high school, but they don't know the intricacies of entomology, and they need to have accurate information and management information of insect pests. Or I'd like to say, you know, instead of what is it, how to get rid of it, how to appreciate it before you come to that question, you know, how do I get rid of it?
Yeah.
So
maybe it's not bad. Maybe you don't need to get rid of it.
That's right. Yeah. So if there's some degree of understanding about a life cycle, their behavior, the benefits that they have, then they indeed might pull back a little bit on that question and invent a new question.
It sounds like you fulfill a really important part of the mission of the land-grant university, which is what the University of Nebraska.
That's right. You know, I guess the greatest pride I take is with the university system. Basically does not have conflicts of interest like you might find in industry or something commercial. And so we specialize or try hard to be an accurate, non-biased, objective source of information for clientele of Nebraska. And so I feel great. That has really elated me. You know, I've just been really excited about the fact that, you know, whatever we say, you know, essentially is trusted by Nebraskans and by everybody else who have issues or questions, and even people in industry and growers in agriculture turn to the University of Nebraska diagnosticians and entomologists for the information they need to know so that they can have the right remedy to a situation, or the right management tactics or whatever. So I feel good about that. I hope the university never loses that or never compromises on that.
It's an important piece of why I think we are in the jobs that we're in.
Right.
So. Oh, yeah. Having been in industry and my, you know, your motivation through, I don't know, whatever you're getting paid or whatnot.
Right.
Is to sell. And so you are selling those treatments. You need to sell. You need to tell that customer why that pest is bad or why that is a pest and why it's bad and why they need to pay you to come
right.
in and help.
Right.
Whereas our jobs now is we're educating, we're teaching them to appreciate things for what it is and what it is
right.
in nature. And yes, there are some things that are pests to humans, mm-hmm. and we will help them make good decisions.
Right. And we also have a chance, or we have opportunities regular to train growers, agricultural growers, field scouts, pest management professionals or pest control operators. And so, you know, on the commercial side, we provide the equipping that they need to do their jobs better as well. And so I like that aspect too, because that's helping to sharpen up that objectivity as well and to create that professional manner of operation in their various companies and industries that people are going to rely upon and continue to use if they are, you know, truly being objective and telling the truth and don't have that conflict of interest of just simply selling a product or some easy remedy. Yeah.
So how did you get started in entomology?
Well, it's a long story. You know, when I was a little kid, I loved ants.
We love ants too. Uh-huh.
And they were the tiny little, those big-headed black ants. Not Molesta, I'm trying to remember. Monomorium minimum. Those little black ants. They have the, some of them have big heads,
okay.
And I would feed him cracker crumbs and things like that on the outside of our house. And then I had a mean big brother, so he'd come along and he'd stamp on him with his feet and kill him. And that just, well, man, it just was such a shock. I couldn't handle it. But
what's
anyway, I'm not gonna say.
Oh, okay.
He didn't bring out the magnifying glass.
He didn't have any appreciation for insects, and so he's just kind of a nasty big brother. That's all I could say when we were that young. He's better now.
That's how we hurt your feelings.
Yeah. So I had an appreciation for ants especially, and then artistic abilities too. So actually, when I went into college, I started in fine arts, and that was back in the 70s. Hey, man, you got to express yourself whatever way, man. Subjective art is where it's at, man. You know, and so – you know, what do you do? Like, I tried to draw my best, paint my best, do whatever I could my best. Hey, man, that's not art. That's illustration. That's illustration, man. And
so, what's the difference there?
Well, an illustrator is somebody who draws something exactly as you see it with whatever medium you use, whether it be pencil, pen, and ink, or whatever. Art is an expression or stylization of some reality that can be so bizarre, but still art. So, but, so you know, I was really crushed, and I had a lot of credit hours in art, and I realized that this isn't where I want to go. So my second most exciting interest was biology. So I went into the University of Nebraska in Omaha and started out with some of their courses there and then transferred in here as a student. So, and then eventually, you know, went through the programs and everything, started a master's degree, and then the kids come along and, hey, I need a job. Right. I need a real job. So fortunately, there was an option of working with cockroaches in research or working in field crops. And so guess what I took?
Cockroaches.
You think I'd want to work with cockroaches? No way. And I don't like cockroaches. When I see them at home, the hair that I have left is raises on the back of my neck. You know, it's like, I hate cockroaches.
So, don't you have roaches in your office?
Yeah, we have brown banded roaches in our office, yeah. But they're not big and ugly like the Oriental cockroaches, so.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, you know, field crops experience, you know, one thing in terms of advice, you know, for somebody who's aspiring to be something in the area of biology or whatever, you know, somehow get a summer job in that department, work hard, be diligent, learn. You'll get a reputation, and that reputation goes as early as it is. It goes a long ways, and so I think essentially with me is that I had that acute interest in insects and biology, and I got a good job, did well, and God gave me the intellect and brightness to do what is right or whatever, to be analytical and whatever gifts I have. But essentially, you know, you hang around someplace a long time, do a good job. The people around you notice, and they'll say, hey, we don't want to lose this person. There's potential here. So I think that's what happened with me. You know, get a full-time job in research for a while in field crops, which I really enjoyed. And then the opportunity for an extension diagnostician came on as well. And fortunately, a lot of fine arts was involved, like photography and drawing, making drawings of insects, line drawings of insects. You know, back in the old days, you know, when you had pen and ink, you couldn't do it on a computer, you know. So So that was a beautiful blend of applying art abilities, illustration abilities, and photography, those fine arts abilities, along with science. I thought it was a perfect blend. I enjoyed doing it, and I still do this very day.
Yeah, and our listeners, if they don't know, if you go on any website, whether it's like a pest control firm or another extension office, your pictures are widely distributed online with, you know, credited.
Yeah,
to
they
you.
Probably are. Yeah.
So
sometimes credited.
It should be.
Yeah.
But the main thing is, photography is, it's like hunting on a micro scale. You know, there's a challenge to it. And you guys know that too, photographing insects, because they're constantly in motion. But if you get that right composition, the right lighting and everything, and everybody needs images of insects. And so, you know, fortunately, we have this digital media now where you get instantaneous shots and you don't have to process film or anything. And you can shoot lots of shots of the same insect over, just like they do with National Geographic, I hear. 2,000 shots on one subject, and then you have to find the best one out of 2,000. But it's not that bad, you know, as far as insects go. But that's satisfying, to shoot insects and then try to do the best I can. And composition-wise, good images, and put them up in a library where everyone in our department can use them as a resource for extension presentations, but also in education here on campus too. So that's very gratifying. Extension, I think, is a wonderful kind of a domain to be in because of the variety of work. You know, it's not just one thing over and over again.
I think that's a good segue into, you said you've been at this job for how long?
33 years.
33 years. 33 years. In 33 years, you've probably seen a lot of cool stuff, right?
Right, yeah, I have.
What were some of the big things when you started 33 years ago?
They're the same ones that you said.
The exact same things.
Just about.
Yeah. So what are we talking about then? Japanese beetle was a big thing?
No, Japanese beetle, not at all.
Oh, bed bugs?
Brown recluse was hardly even distributed across Nebraska. That green June beetle. Uh-huh. The only place where you would have seen those would be in the extreme southeast corner of Nebraska.
Okay.
So we have something like, even in field crops, western bean cutworm, which I worked with in research. It was just a little nook and cranny there in eastern Colorado and the high plains area of Kansas and Nebraska. And now look where it is, all the way eastward to Illinois. So how did that happen? You know, the insect world is dynamic. And, you know, and then along with maybe climate patterns or changes, those kinds of things, things are not static. They're in flux.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, we still have that same old repetitious insects every year, year after year after year. That is, you know, pretty much constitutes what Nebraska is all about. You know, the grasshoppers, the cicadas, those kinds of things, where year after year, you're identifying them for somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you started 33 years ago, you were saying that there were some things that are kind of the same now, but some things have changed. If you were to pick some of the big things that you used to work with that you don't see anymore, what would you say would be some some examples of that?
Yeah, that's a hard one. But, you know, I did have some examples of, like, for example, elm leaf beetle we hardly see anymore.
Right.
And I think that's because of some, tiny little parasitic wasps were released years ago. And these wasps have helped reduce populations of elm leaf beetle, not only in Nebraska, but perhaps regionally.
Right.
And so that's just one of those cases where USDA released something many, many years ago. They're finally numerous enough that they've cut down the populations of elm leaf beetles. But, you know, okay, elm leaf beetle. Now we got another pest of elm. Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I say dynamic. You know, entomology is kind of cool because people are dynamic, constantly moving here, mobility factors, things like that, trade, commerce, wind currents, jet streams, you name it. We got movement of insects going around. So, case in point, elm leaf beetle diminished. But now what's important in elm? Well, we have this little elm flea weevil that riddles tiny little holes in the leaves that everybody is concerned about.
It's a leaf miner as a larva, and
mm-hmm.
it does the shot hole damage.
Yeah, all those little shot hole damage. And everybody loves, you know, elm is a great shade tree if, in fact, it has intact foliage.
Right. There's not little holes all throughout it.
Yeah. So, you know, that's just an example. I was thinking, well, we have also, like, cigarette beetles, lots of tobacco smoking going on in the '70s, eighties and the like. And so cigarette beetle got that name. Not only it was basically a pest of dried cured plant materials, including tobacco. And so it was more prevalent years ago. Hey, what's riddling holes in my cigar? Right. I just bought that, my fine Cuban illegal cigar back in the '70s. But, you know,
now
stuff
you might
like
see
that.
Them in potpourri more likely than.
Yeah, potpourri, yeah.
I see those in spices.
Mm-hmm. Spices.
And that's about it. What about clothes moths?
Clothes moths. Yeah, you know, like most carpets way back when, up to about the 70s, I still think you can buy carpets that are 100% wool. But woolen carpets were very common, or woolen rugs. And so with some degree of neglect, certain areas of the carpet, especially in the corners, you know, would become infested with case-making clothes moths or the webbing clothes moths. So we don't hear about that much anymore because, you know, we don't have a polyester moth yet.
No, not yet.
But you never know.
It'll happen someday, I'm sure. What about, I'm trying to think of something in turf. You mentioned an urban thing. What about green bug?
Oh, yeah, well, green bug and turf, you know.
Is it kind of diminished here?
Yeah, it has. Yeah. You know, and I think, and that has a lot to do, I think, with whether it was a biotype that was for green bug, but green bug also in grain sorghum, you know, in Nebraska years ago, grain sorghum was a large plantings of grain sorghum, and so green bug went along with that. And so, of course, we don't have that so much anymore, so. Anyway,
so things go, come and go.
Chinch bugs, you know, chinch bugs in turf at some time, but chinch bugs in wheat, so you don't see that too much anymore either. So
that's why I think it's important, though, to sometimes do things like this, to really look over a period of history of insects and entomology in mm-hmm. a region and really understand that things have changed quite a lot.
Right.
Not only have different crops come and gone and different kinds of products in the house come and gone, but we've got different insecticides that also probably changes the way that things interact with us.
Yeah.
Well, and we both recently got back from vacation with our separate families, and we did road trips back east. And we both texted each other commenting on how there aren't a lot of bugs on the windshield, except in certain parts of Iowa when all the Japanese beetles were smashing into our windshield.
Yeah, I mean, they're hard. Yeah.
Have you noticed that throughout the last 30 years?
You know, it is interesting. The patterns, again, I think somewhere it was in the 1990s, the latter part of the 1990s. All right. There were so many butterflies that were abundant in northeastern Nebraska that when we were driving, we felt awful because we're driving on the highway and we're just constantly killing them with the windshield.
Right.
And it just crushed us. But, you know, that was at the point, I think, when the Department of Roads was planting a lot of wildflowers along the roadsides. And in that particular year or two, there simply were high numbers of butterflies. And so you think of the example last year, we had painted lady butterflies crazy.
Yeah.
And that's a rarity. It's one of those fascinating things where one insect cycles in its numbers year after year. And so that happened to be a peak where, for whatever reason, you know, there were painted lady butterflies everywhere to such an extent that they even showed up in the latter part of the summer on radar at the Denver airport.
Yeah, we got a lot of calls.
We have talked before about what's the weird bug going to be this year. Jody and I've done this 4 years. Jody's done it 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the years I've been here, there has been one insect that I did not anticipate that just all of a sudden exploded. In 2016, it was earwigs. I had hundreds of earwigs come into the office and calls and emails about them. Last year, it was painted ladies. This year, so far, it's been soldier beetles. It's been this weird abundance of soldier beetles. And everybody always wants to know why it's happening. But like you're saying, sometimes we just don't know. I don't think.
Yeah, you don't know.
It's hard to tell what happened. Was there a release of a disease that didn't happen? Was the weather just right? Was there,
you know, the
El Nino?
Yeah. Well, in the springtime, you know, you get these jet streams, the southern jets in the springtime that bring it, depending on where they curve, they bring in certain numbers of insects, which then have an advantage to reproduce, at least as long as foods are available and reach high numbers. I was thinking about Pyomodes itch mites, and that was in the year 2000. Boy, it's a long time now. 2005 to 2007. But essentially, you know, in that given year, and there's still repercussions of this even now to this day, where people are asking, "Do I have oak itch mites?" You know, or "Do I have them there Pyomodes itch mites in my yard or whatever? I got all these itchy spots and everything like that." Well, you know, in that year, I think it was 2005, I checked some weather factors because I was trying to figure out this. But across the most of the country, including the Midwest and the Great Plains, the weather was moderate. There were no high extremes of high temperature. And so during that course of that summer, you almost have what we call like incubation conditions temperature-wise. So
right.
Here we have one kind of an insect, a little maggot that gets into oak leaves. The conditions are just right for it to have reproduced and create all these little galls with maggot larvae in them. Good to something, you know, as a prey, you know, as a prey, it would be good for something, but it's protected in these galls. And so obviously there's these Pyomodes itch mites that happen to be in the landscape, probably in low numbers. But, you know, that food source coming available, their ability to get into those galls and feed on those gall gnat or fly larvae gave them an advantage to just explode in populations. And so here come the late summer, fall, then we have people just complaining, you know, almost like an epidemic.
Right.
I got all these bites and blisters on my body and my face and shoulders, and my kids are, you know, they look like spider bites. My kids are getting sick. They're getting flu-like symptoms and elevated temperatures and stuff like that. And so that was really interesting to pursue because we had no idea what it was at first. The mite itself was of European origin, so when did it show up?
Oh, yeah.
An arboreal kind of a mite, more so, you know, in trees and the like. So perfect scenario that had developed preceding those years, I'm sure, which led to this outbreak that everybody's still reverberating from, you know. Yeah. Do I have Pyomodes itch mites? Well, you know, that might be a 1 in 100 year
right.
kind of an event.
So. Yeah, and it's all so my article for the Nevline for next month is about the itch mites, because mm-hmm. people keep calling and asking about them.
Right.
But there's not a way, I guess the hard part is there's no way to predict it.
Right.
And then there's no way to prevent the bites unless you stay inside forever.
Right. It was so bad that year that people actually sold their houses who lived in neighborhoods where there were pin oak trees and other oak trees. They actually sold their houses and left. And even in spite of, you know, what you could tell them is this just happens. It's not going to happen year after year. It's just a bad year. So.
Didn't buy it.
didn't buy it, yeah.
So that's an episodic outbreak kind of situation.
Correct, yeah.
I've seen in a talk that you've given before, and I remembered this from a while back, you talked about ground beetles.
Yeah.
That attacked Sydney, Nebraska.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, you know, this can happen even in our country or the part of the state too. Beetles, especially in acreages that are idle, you know, like CRP acres or ground beetles being predators, they have to feed on something to increase in numbers. But here we get these episodes, and I think they kind of occur every five or six years or something, where their numbers build up in, you know, High Plains, Nebraska, where there's a lot of pasture land and grasslands and the like. And then, you know, peak time, May or June or something like that, lights on or in the house, or, you know, in the city, this town at night, all these beetles come out, strongly attracted to lights. We know that even on our porch lights here in Lincoln, Omaha, Lincoln areas too. You know, you have your porch light on at night, you're going to invite a lot of insects to your doorstep. Well, you know, here you're out in the dark High Plains community. The lights are on. There's just countless thousands and thousands of beetles, and they're heading for that light.
Right.
And so they converge on the town, and they're everywhere.
Right.
In thousands. I can't believe it. You know, gas stations, you're swiping them off your face and shoulders. You're trying to pump gas in your car, that kind of thing.
Just crawling all over everything.
Yeah, and, you know, and that happens with June beetles. Crickets, yeah.
Millipedes, I'm getting calls about right now.
Right, where numbers are just build up, you know. That's what I like about the whole thing, though, is the conditions that lead up to these things. There's still a sense of mystery about them.
Yes. We're on the edge of knowledge. Yes. And we're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
So those are some outbreak kind of situations. What about some trends that you're noticing? Is anything going up as your career has progressed?
Well, I would say probably, you know, brown recluse spider is one. Okay. And there's not only just a publicity about it that has raised concern or awareness across the state.
Right.
But, and like we talked about green June beetles, there are a number of insects and spiders that are just on the move, and they're spreading across the state, both northward and westward. Another one is the Lone Star tick. Again, yeah. It was considered like along the Missouri River in extreme southeastern Nebraska. Now it seems like it's followed the tributaries, Platte River, and it's pretty much in central Nebraska, moving into southwestern Nebraska, north of Omaha.
Wow.
And so Lone Star tick, a number of people are concerned about, of course, because of a number of reasons. They don't pull off very easy. They leave their mouth parts usually lodged in the skin. And they're capable of spreading some disease symptoms that are similar to Lyme disease. So there's some concern there.
One of our past guests,
Travis Bure
of Creighton, he talked about how they're very aggressive, but they'll like chase people down to feed on them, and that he had always heard they were not in the central part of the state, but his research is showing exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, they get on you and they will bite you at your ankles and your feet even before they even start migrating.
They don't want to. They don't want to wait. They just want to glom on real quick.
They don't even
quick.
Give you a chance to find them. Them
hungry ticks.
Two of my favorites that I feel like have increased since even I've been here are the carpenter bee and the cicada killer wasp.
Right.
And I feel like, because they provision their nest, and each year they'll come out, and they do tend to nest in the same location annually, or, you know, over and over again. Will there ever get to be a point where our places are overrun and people are going to need to treat for them?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. You know, like with cicada killer wasps, they follow the cicadas. All right.
Right.
So, okay, what do cicadas need for sustenance? You know, they need to feed on trees and shrubs. And so you can see a pattern where they are dependent upon, you know, forested areas, so they can feed on the cicada nymphs feed on the roots of those trees and shrubs. So, of course, if their numbers are high, then, of course, the cicada killers are going to be following that population of cicadas. And so we're getting increasing urbanization going on.
Yeah, because they're using the trees in our yards now.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The cicadas.
And then what was the other one?
Yeah, the carpenter bee.
Yeah, carpenter bees. That one too. Yeah. Same way. It was sort of like what's coming out of southeastern Nebraska and moving north and west. Because that seems to be a scenario that fits a lot of insects over the years, at least the decades that I've been here. So
is that because of the river or just this proximity?
You know, I'm thinking again that moderate winters is what I'm thinking of. And then, you know, increased mobility again, commercial mobility, goods and people moving and that kind of thing contributes to insect spread as well, or spider spread as well.
Do you think Nebraska is a very interesting state for that type of?
It's a loaded question.
Well, you know.
What do we have to say?
When it comes to like field guides and things, there's always, you know, so and so for the east.
Yeah.
For the west. And then Nebraska's never on the map.
Nebraska is a place where people travel through to get to the Rocky Mountains.
yes.
Yeah, there's some really neat things about Nebraska. I mean, you think about Pine Ridge, you know, up there in the Panhandle and along the Platte River, the history, the eastern forests, you know, and the sandhill cranes and the like. There's a lot of stuff in Nebraska that can be missed if you're just passing through.
Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
But if we had like a field guide for all the insects in Nebraska,
how
amazing would that be?
Entomologically, I think that this is a fascinating place. I think that there's a lot of confluence here. It's like that part of the Amazon River right. that runs up into the ocean, where you're starting to see this mixture of Eastern and Western species.
Yeah, they won't go all the way to the mountain.
Right.
And then it's like, well, they're not going to cross the river.
Right.
And then it's too cold. And so it's like,
so it is interesting.
Everyone forgets about us.
You know, it's like when you're a diagnostician, what do we have in our libraries? You know, we have books about the butterflies of Western North America and the Rocky Mountains. Yeah. And then we have the butterflies of Eastern North America or Eastern United States. And so, yeah, we are that kind of like that transition zone or just the overlap zone.
You can see us. No, there's no information. Like, on both things. Like, you can see the state, but there's not. Like, so do we have all of them? Or do we have none of them? No, we have a lot. We have some really great things here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it is. Oh, what I was going to say was when you said no one really stops, I was like, hence the reason we moved to a smaller house, because we no longer need a guest room.
That's funny.
There's a reason it's called the Oregon Trail and not the Nebraska Trail.
But, you know, along the Platte River, you know, that the bridge by Kearney, you know, there's a lot of neat developments going on that, that do attract and hold tourists coming through.
Carhenge.
Yeah, I haven't been out to Scouts Bluff, I mean, but I want to. But the sandhills are amazing.
Oh, yes.
Amazing.
This episode of Arthur Pod brought to you by VisitNebraska.com.
And you think about grasshoppers. I mean, that's one reason. One of the big insect issues we had when the land was being settled in Nebraska, grasshoppers, especially Rocky Mountain locusts sweeping into the area and totally wiping everything out. That is hard to imagine that they would eat everything to the ground and even deeper.
Right.
You know?
Chew the screens out your windows.
Yeah, and we've had that happen a couple, maybe 20 years ago. They were so bad in eastern Nebraska, they were chewing the nylon screens. Yeah, they still do on occasion.
Sounds like a here and there. Nightmare.
Yeah. Have you read that book by Jeffrey Lockwood?
No.
Locust? I keep meaning to. It's about the Rocky Mountain.
Yeah, that there's some remnants of their bodies up in some melting glaciers in Montana and Wyoming.
Yeah. But,
you know, where did they come from? Why did they disappear?
That's the question.
This is what makes entomology so fascinating.
Okay, read that book. Get back to us in your book report.
Well, I'm afraid that when they thaw out from the glacier up there
and revive,
it'll be like a bee horror movie.
And some devious entomologist is going to try to take the DNA and create the the original Rocky Mountain locust.
If you see those entomology themed horror movies, there's always a devious entomologist that's up to no good. So we've kind of talked about some of the trends, some of the different outbreaks that you've experienced. As we head towards the wrap up here, I was kind of curious if you could share some of the weirdest things that you've seen over the course of your career. I feel like I've seen a lot of weird stuff just in 4 years. So I have to imagine that you've seen some pretty interesting cases.
One of them that struck me real early in diagnoses was cordyceps fungal infestation of insects. This was a big scarab like you'd see in a tree, like the stag beetle grub or, you know,
like but leather beetle?
A big, huge white grub, several of them. This was in northeastern Nebraska. And the thing that was brought to me was these grubs, and they were totally hardened and mummified, and they had big, huge, tall antlers on their coming out of their heads. I'm not kidding.
That's awesome.
And it's a particular fungus that infests insects, not just white grubs, but insects in the soil. And it creates this dense matting of fungi, you know, in their bodies and consumes all the nutrients and just has this woody kind of a mummified grub left. And then in order to reproduce or whatever, it creates these little stalks that come out of the ground that look like antlers out of the head. It was bizarre.
It's amazing.
But cordyceps, you know, C-O-R-D-E-C-Y-P-S, cordyceps fungi. Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah.
I like that one.
If that ever came to me, I'd have to call Jim.
Well, see, you know, there you go. You know, if you were segueing toward an ending here, you know, one thing I have to say is if you want to become an expert, you know, it always has to be in a team context. And so I relied on experts that were in our department, older people just like I have become, for answers to questions I didn't have. And, of course, I had many questions back then. And then as you gain the experience. But then again, you know, our own colleagues in the field of entomology, some of them are specialists in certain areas, and we rely upon each other to give those answers that we simply can't find or will take so much time to look up and to resolve. So it's a good thing that we have entomologists who have varied interests in specialty areas. Yeah. And then we all work as a team, and then we rely on our older, you know, more experienced people as well to provide information for us.
I do love that about entomology and extension. I may not know the answer, but I know the person who does.
Yeah, there you go. And it's not Google all the time.
No, it isn't. It's frequently an email to a colleague somewhere across the country.
Online resources are nice too, like Bug Guide, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They're very helpful, but I still prefer the books, the actual hard books with pages you can turn.
Yeah, and I've been here. You've helped me identify multiple things, and I see the process that you go through, and I mean, you work so hard going through keys and rearing out samples and things like that. So I can speak for both of us saying that we really appreciate your help and your friendship and everything you've taught us. Yeah.
Thank you.
We're going to cry every day for the rest of our careers
and
that you're not here.
Helpless, but helpless, helpless.
We'll have to find a cell phone.
Yeah, and if you want to see a picture of Jim and lots of videos, then you just have to go on the YouTube channel for Backyard Farmer. How long have you been on the show?
Oh, I think about 1990, pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah. But again, you know, it's been fun. Like I say, the diversity of activities in entomology, in extension, 4-H included.
Superintendent of the state fair.
Yeah, and always being at the head of trying to identify something that is really, really important or really difficult to identify. I mean, that's the challenge, and I think we all enjoy that, if you have the time.
Well, thank you, Jim, for being on. We really appreciate it. This, I think, is going to be a great episode when we get it out. And we'd like to thank you all for listening. And if you want to find us on the web, we are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter at @JLarson_UNL.
I'm at @JodyBugsMeUNL.
Jim, are you on the Twitter, the Tweet Pals?
Oh, no.
You have a Facebook page.
But you have a Facebook page.
I do have a Facebook ID Lab page.
Okay. What's that called?
Facebook ID Lab.
So look Jim up on
Ento ID
Way
Lab.
To be creative.
Look him up on Facebook and like his page. He has lots of cool pictures that he posts there and little factoids when he puts those up. So thanks for listening. If you can find us on Switcher or iTunes, give us a review, and we'll see you next time on Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.